This is CKGI, Gabriola Co-op Radio.
Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. Gonna mulch it deep and low, gonna make it fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, please bless these seeds I sow. Please keep them safe below till the rains come tumbling down.
Hello, everyone. My name is Naomi Beth Walken, and I am an essayist and the inaugural Poet Laureate of Nanaimo. This series of readings is called Bookmobile. They are my musings on books, writers, and the writer's life in the form of a mixture of essays and poetry that I call ESPO. I hope they will encourage your own writing and also suggest some books that you might like to dip into. The theme of this episode is gardening and gardening books.
Gonna make this garden grow. Gonna mulch it deep and low, gonna make it fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, please bless these seeds I sow. Please keep them safe below till the rains come tumbling down.
I'm going to start with some notes from my spring gardening diary. Already the peas are up and the rows of green garlic stems mark where I'd planted the bulbs last October. I've spent a good part of the winter slipping in the odd garden book reading just to keep my spirits up in the hopes our harvest will be good this year. Don't wear perfume in the garden unless you want to be pollinated by bees. So says Anne Raver, and people demanding garden writing be in small bites and sexy could hardly ask for better than this. The main problem with garden writing, I feel, is not lack of sexiness, but how to cover the basics for the continually arriving new gardener, while at the same time approaching topics in a fresh way and with recent scientific input for the advanced gardener, all the while keeping the reader on side, if not totally entranced. There's so much freebie information on the web as regards the pruning of roses, etc., that garden writers need a certain slant, a particular niche, in order to attract attention. Above all, there has to be a passion there and an ability to seduce the reader into the passion. Most garden writing is factual, for that is what the reader demands. When is the best time to prune? How can bulbs be protected from rodents? Black spot on roses? Well, you get the idea. It is said that gardening, garden writing, should not become a metaphor for growth, love, relationships, and other aspects of human behaviour. I'm not sure who said this, but I stand in exactly the opposite corner, for I like garden writing to be intense and passionate. Talk about anemones as if they were the most important thing in the world, and parsley as if it springs from the fountain of youth. As Paula Punish so aptly says, gardening needs its own literature of recovery. Russell Page's claims that green fingers are the extension of a verdant heart runs along the same lines, though it may produce guilt, as in my own case, where black spot and canker on the roses seems to tell everyone of my less than verdant vital body part. Remember, gardening, unlike other forms of healing, has carrots. As Ruth Stout says, there is peace in the garden, peace and results. Other slants for garden writing I enjoy include history in the garden, for example, Versailles, and books about the process, such as the brilliant Suburban Safari by Hannah Holmes, or Richard Goodman's charming French Dirt about his gardening experiences in a small village near Avignon. For myself, I can get any gardening how-to I need to know through Google. And anyway, when it comes to details for gardeners such as myself, as Des Kennedy points out, a few grains of information are seldom sufficient to derail instinct under a full head of steam. So for garden writing, I lean to literary efforts. Garden writers I love must start with Jamaica Kincaid, with her feisty opinions and lackadaisical gardening style. She doesn't tell you how to do anything. In fact, she's probably a good example of how not to garden, as she loses tools in the compost and orders masses of plants that all arrive on the same day with no ground prepared for them. She states her own garden writing preference when describing a book by Sally Festig on Gertrude Jekyll. She says, "This book is very decent and discreet, just the qualities I want in a friend, but not in a book I'm reading." Her own garden books are full of gossips and asides. Her philosophy is very attractive. People who know exactly where what they are doing always end up with exactly what they are doing. Her writing is always coloured by her ancestors having been brought over as slaves to Antigua to work the rubber plantations, and so has a definite passion and direction to it. There is no gardening aspect that Miss Kincaid can't compare, contrast, or parallel with the injustice of her slave ancestry. She describes this consciousness so clearly. "Should it be an idea? Should it be an open wound? Each breath I take in and expel, healing and opening the wound again, over and over? Or is it a long moment that begins anew each day since 1492? Startling if you're just searching out how to prune your roses, but as you must know by now, I'm not a gardener or reader who just wants information. The beginning of her book, My Garden, could be described as a hybrid of Gertrude Stein and an upscale gardening catalogue, as her much-repeated phrases are punctuated with Latin names for plants. In spite of this, her vitality is irresistible and her enthusiasm will sweep you away. That was Jamaica Kincaid, My Garden. Anne Raver, she of the sexy quote, is a brilliant garden writer for the New York Times, who uses the garden essay form the way I like it. You can write about love as sphinx moths visit the evening primroses opening up at dusk and bats swoop in to sip nectar from the saguaro cactus. You can write about death as the soldier bug prongs a Mexican beetle lunching on a leaf. As you can see, she hangs any topic she wants into the frame of gardens. Rosemary Veery is the doyen of English garden writers. As Anne Raven describes Veery's books, they are not only filled with countless ideas and how-tos, but her delightful references to early garden literature also serve as a kind of joyful syllabus for self-education. And speaking of early garden references, I came across a curious book the other day that surveys a whole slew of early garden writers, from pioneer settler gardeners to those of ladies accompanying their lordships to various short-term colonial postings, to writers on railway station gardens, writers pleading for quiet Sundays, to modern magazine writers promoting self-sufficiency, a kind of replay of pioneer gardens, so that we might all make a smaller footprint. The collection is called Garden Voices, and it's a survey of Canadian garden writing. The couple who've researched and gathered these interesting pieces of writing together are Edwida von Baer and Pleasance Crawford, perfect names that one might indeed have conjured up for garden writers appearing in a piece of fiction. Some quotes from their book might include Carol Jean Grand's, "A garden feels like a victory, ground gained against a sense of widespread social chaos that has begun to feel like a norm. Carol was a CBC radio gardening personality in the 80s. I also very much like her quote that makes gardening almost a political statement. She says, "That is why gardening is not only political but subversive. Nothing works like people who quietly assert their powers to reclaim their humanness, beginning with understanding how to feed themselves. Politics begins with a garden. No one can live, yet alone protest, on an empty stomach." I just love fresh approaches and claims for justifying something we just enjoy doing anyway. Another writer in this collection is Roscoe Fillmore, who tells the new suburbanites of his time to get their hands in the mud and never mind the rubber gloves. And please do not do this just to keep up with the Joneses. He adds, and avoid aping each other. Another unusual book on gardening that I actually keep on my shelf of all-time favorites is a rare one. I managed to get its 10th impression, which is dated 1939. It is the witty garden writing classic by Carol Čapek called The Gardener's Year. I'm particularly fond of the account he gives in it of a gardener who decides to go away on holiday in August, and so asks his neighbour to pop over occasionally to check things out. In anxiety, each day he is away, he sends more and more detailed instructions for the neighbour. Of course, the neighbour's overloaded and fails miserably. On returning to a ruined garden, our gardener vows never to do such a foolish thing again. Another of Čapek's essays concerns itself with how a gardener buys up a whole lot of plants for a vacant patch of earth, only to find, on the first spade dig, that he has forced out a mass of roots, on top of which a whole clump of buds is clustered. "God Almighty," moans the gardener, "I've got Trolius here." It is brilliant writing and holds a good moral. If you start a garden, you'd better stay with it. It's worth trying Amazon for this book. That's Carol Čapek's The Gardener's Year. For several years, I provided poems to accompany slides from the beautiful gardens of our garden club members here on Gabriola. And here are a few for you now. The first one is called Bones. As God's creating, how we make our gardens into our own image. The skin of fences and hedges, the spine of a path to the front door, and limb bones of wandering tracks and trails, bark, mulch, gravel, crushed seashells, whatever the island can provide. Internal organs can be fitted later. It's the bones that allow our gardens to stir, allow our gardens to dance. The next poem is called Discontent. Not content to order nature in our gardens, we also demand whimsy, the metal frog and dancing figure, the steel heron that will never steal fish, the pottery birds that look wistfully up at an overflowing bird feeder, a dragon scarcely moving over the sandy soil towards a stone duck which stands perplexed by the concrete leaves embedded in the pathway. And add to this the rusty barrows, broken tubs and bike baskets overflowing with nasturtiums, and everywhere the flash of blue, chairs, pots, lanterns, spicing the greens. Our discontent with nature's efforts impel us to nudge her along here, along there. The next poem is called The Needy Gardener. What do we need in gardens? We pot, so we need sheds. We protect, so we need fences. We go up and down, so we need steps. We plant roses, so we need arches. We sit in the shade, so we need pagodas and benches. We offer support to peas and beans and grapes, so we need tripods and obelisks. We need to quieten the needs, so we need labyrinths. When winter comes, we close the door and sit by the fire. But January brings the first seed catalogues, and then how we knead all over again. And the last poem, Gabriola Gardner's. We Gabriola Gardners may lack the Versailles touch, may be a little too laid back for a variety of reasons. Still, our gardens demand a certain respect from those city types who come to criticize and stay to admire. Our spiritual labyrinths, our meditation groves, our wabi-sabi use of sandstone and driftwood. The touches only islanders can give to shallow soil, water scarce, plots of hopefulness.
I am losing my reason after spending a season in the island retreat I selected. To my rural existence, I've developed resistance in a way I had not quite expected. I have carpenter ants, and the deer eat my plants, so my language you'll just have to pardon. Godspeed the machete, and let's shred to confetti the remains of my ill-fated garden. The task of manuring is none too alluring, and the smell I find frankly alarming. My plants thought it splendid, but there my luck ended, for the slugs found it equally charming. I have carpenter ants, and the deer eat my plants, so my language you'll just have to pardon. Godspeed the machete, and let's shred to confetti the remains of my ill-fated garden. I have wrought so offensive and repairs so expensive that my house has me quite broken-hearted. It's now so infested that the cat has protested and has taken her fleas and departed. I have carpenter ants, and the deer eat my plants, so my language you'll just have to pardon. Godspeed the machete, and let's shred to confetti the remains of my ill-fated garden. My hair is completely grey, and I can't stand another day. I intend to exact retribution for what I can't liquidize, mangle, slash, burn, and vaporize. High explosives may be the solution. I have carpenter ants, and the deer eat my plants, so my language you'll just have to pardon. Godspeed the machete, and let's shred to confetti the remains of my ill-fated garden.
That gardening song is by Gabriola's witty songstress, Alison Humphreys.
Hi, my name is Cheryl Reed, and you are listening to Gabriola Co-op Radio, my station, my island.
At the moment, I'm merely fretting about all the many chores I have to do before I put the garden to bed for the year. Just the thought of them is making me a little weary. I often prefer reading about gardening to actually doing it, so while making my garden to-do list, I jotted down a few more thoughts I had on garden writing and folks who do it. Michael Pollan points out so nicely that writing and gardening are both ways of rendering the world in rows. His garden rows, reminiscent of his grandfather's, are straight, his writing circuitous. His wonderful essays in his many books, Second Nature being my favourite, wind this way and that, each winding revealing a fresh point of view on a mundane gardening aspect. He speaks touchingly of the way he described his own garden to his 90-year-old grandfather as, "It was one of those places that is neither exactly in the past nor in the future, but that anyone who gardens is ever moving towards." One of my favourite bits of his writing, also in Second Nature, questions Thoreau, as I often do. To Thoreau's queries, "Do these beans not grow for woodchucks too? How then can our harvest fail? Shall I not rejoice also at the abundance of the weeds, whose seeds are the granary of birds?" Pollen succinctly replies, "Sure, Henry, rejoice and starve." Now, that's my kind of garden writing. If there is one book all recent garden writers are agreed on as a fine model for garden writing, it would be Eleanor Perenya's A Writer in the Garden. Her name suggests an Edwardian lady with a touch of the Hungarian exotic. Her picture on the back of this book is of a dyed blonde with a cocktail glass in one hand and a cigarette in the other, to remind you that her opinionated and witty comments come from being a one-time managing editor of Mademoiselle magazine. Take 50 garden topics, gather reference books, dig up garden gossip of past and present gardens, and watch your own hands and eyes and other senses of torture, and weave it all together into enchanting small essays, and you will have done what Eleanor Perenya did when she wrote her one, and unfortunately only one, gardening book, A Writer in the Garden. The chapters are dense and worth chewing over carefully. Her opinions are forceful, even though they may be incorrect. At least they don't waver. For example, in regard to Jerusalem artichokes, she comments, "Even the flowers are inferior. Away with it, I say. It would take a strong soul to try growing Jerusalem artichokes after reading that, I would imagine." Des Kennedy quotes and denies Perenya's firm affirmation that two companionable people who've assembled their material can prepare an asparagus bed in a long springtime afternoon. But then Des and his wife garden on a pile of rocks in the Georgia Strait, so what can they expect? When speaking of asters, Miss Perenya says, "I can't resist them and invariably let optimism get in the way of better judgment, which, come to think of it, may be the first principle of gardening." When writing of garden full of the newest and showiest hybrids, she compares it to a woman with a facelift. This is delicious writing. So that was Eleanor Perenya's A Writer in the Garden. Des Kennedy himself is high on my list of garden writers, partly because he covers my neck of the woods, living as he does on Denman Island, which is close to my own island of Gabriola. His writing is full of delicious metaphors, is rarely didactic, although he knows his subject well, and is never boring. He makes me laugh out loud, and that is always a plus when most garden writing fills me with feelings of guilt and insufficiency. I can forgive him going over the top occasionally with the comparisons in his writings, such as the one that our relationship to trees is similar to the Inuit throat singers as they exchange breath back and forth. His description of a storm on his shallow soil island could well describe a storm on Gabriola. Lying awake during a storm, rigid with terror, I wait for one of the giants to come down and flatten our house. Anyone can add this kind of excitement to their lives by simply getting a huge, shallow-planted tree growing close to the house on the windward side. Close to my home writing and deliciously accurate. And who but Des would have a chapter on money in a gardening book, as he does in Crazy About Gardening. Here he points out the dangers of the two extremes. The insolence of wealth leeches charm out of a garden as surely as incessant rain leeches out nutrients. Too much of money can overwhelm a garden, as sure as too little may impoverish it. So that was Des Kennedy's Crazy About Gardening. Other gardening titles worth a whiff, one that I mentioned earlier, French Dirt by Richard Goodman, a charming story of a short-lived garden near Avignon. Then there's the amazing story of the flower business, Flower Confidential by Amy Stewart, covering everything from sexual harassment in the Ecuadorian greenhouses to Dutch flower auctions and high-end New York florists, where a modest bunch of tulips and roses cost $75. And another book by Michael Collin you'll like, The Botany of Desire, his brilliant essays on four plants: apple, tulip, marijuana, and potato. And the garden classic of someone considered by aficionados in his time as possibly the best garden writer alive, Christopher Lloyd. Although he's dead now, his book, The Well-Tempered Garden, lives on. Someone bind and gag me, there are so many great gardening books out there. Whether garden writers should be active gardeners seems weighted on the dirt under the fingernails school of thought. Paula Panish's complaint that writing about gardens and plants has been placed firmly into a cultural category, at least in America, of something that smells faintly of genteel ladies' cologne and has the feel of flower-trimmed hats worn to luncheon. It's firmly counteracted by smart, tough garden writers, as books such as Jamaica's Kincaid, My Garden, that I mentioned at the beginning. What's for sure, as Des Kennedy points out, writing and gardening are very similar callings. Once you've got the itch to do either, nothing this side of the apocalypse can stop you. If you've decided to do both, then you're surely verging on the edge of madness. Eleanor Perenyi has the final word here, I think. A writer who gardens is, sooner or later, going to write a book about the subject. I take that as inevitable. As a garden writer, I restrict myself to poetry, for as Isidorus of Miletus is quoted, "If one does not know the names, one's knowledge of things is useless," which about sums me up as a garden writer. I use poetic form to express my feelings in the garden, particularly the haiku form. My experience of the garden is mostly moments, the moments when everything clicks into place and the world sings, and for such moments, haiku are demanded. Sudden wealth, open for Scythia and crocus on our breakfast table. Gardening is an artificial thing, a man-against-nature kind of activity, where, over time, nature usually manages to cover things with vines. Still, as Michael Pollan states hopefully, the garden suggests there might be a place where we can meet nature halfway. And on some days, when the roses are in full bloom and the fruit is ripening on our loaded trees, one can almost go along with those hopes.
Mm-hmm.
Scarborough Fair. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love of mine. Tell her to make me a cambric shirt, a deep forest green, parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, and snow-crested brown, without no steam or night or world. The child of a fountain, she'll be a true love of mine. Strands and polishes a gun, she'll be a true love of mine. Tell her to reap it in a sickle of blazing in scarlet battalion. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and girls born in the soldiers to kill.
Blazing in scarlet battalion.
Parsley, sage, at Scarborough Fair. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme.